Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, listeners. This is Daniel here with the inaugural episode of a new Cannonball side project series, Space is the Place. This is, you'll still be getting your regular Cannonballs. This is not a replacement or anything. This is additional content. This is bonus. Not bonus. That makes it sound like this is somehow, I don't know, not a serious endeavor. In any case, before I dig too deep of a hole for myself, I'm thrilled to introduce you to my intrepid interlocutor, my co-host on this journey, Mr. Gigi Launchbow. Gigi, how are you tonight?
Pretty good. Just keeping busy.
Fantastic. All right, man. Well, we'll go ahead and I guess just explain to everybody and also explain to Gigi why I've wrapped him into this. So the idea was one that so both Claude and I have been talking about sort of expanding the Cannonball concept. And Claude has taken the lead on a side project where he will be examining kind of the contemporary canon, that is recent literary fiction that has come to be accepted as this is the good stuff nowadays. And I sort of thought to myself, well, I'm not very smart. I'm not a culture maven exactly, but there's one thing I do have an abiding interest in. It is the genre of science fiction, and especially the kind of the way that it has developed over the, let's call it, two centuries of its existence. Not only is it something I just have a personal interest in because it's what I enjoy reading, I think it's also a fascinating story to look at kind of popular culture and how it interacts with the world around it. So I got my pal Gigi on the horn. He is a fella who I have known via the internet for a number of years. We've podcasted before, in fact, on a minute by minute, a Talking Cat podcast, as I recall.
Yes.
but I knew he would be the guy to talk to because I think he shares some similar elements of interest and fascination with me. So actually, I kind of wanted, before we get started in today's topic, the book we're talking about today, I did want to give us all a chance to, the listeners to get to know us from the standpoint we're coming from, and also just for Gigi and I to sort of understand what where we're coming from with all this. So Gigi, what's kind of your broad history with the genre of science fiction? When did you first get into it and what drew you to it?
Well, I've liked science fiction for a long time. As far as Jules Verne goes, gosh, I don't know. I'm pretty sure I probably read it first. Some paperbacks I found in the basement from my dad when I was middle school age or something like that. I've read a fair number of his before. Science fiction wise, right now I'm reading a lot of Charles Stross. I kind of tend more towards the fantasy-ish science fiction, a little more to weird science fiction, instead of the more hard science fiction. I was never really an Asimov guy. I read more Clark. I've read, a little bit of so forth. But yeah, I like the weird stuff a little more than the hard science fiction. But like with the Jules Verne, it really falls into the adventure stuff. And I've read a lot of that too. You know, when I was a little, it's one of those things when you're a little kid and you get hooked on the series of books that are, you know, not really a kid's book. So, like, I read all the Clive Cussler books when I was, you know, like sixth grade.
Yeah. So for me, that was Michael Crichton. I read his entire oeuvre.
Oh, same here. And Tom Clancy.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Red Storm Rising. It's a classic.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, listeners at home. I'm experiencing some connection problems. Do not blame Gigi for this. My internet is not at its best, so you might hear us asking each other if we're there for a little bit here. But please, bear with us. Anyway, Gigi, continue.
I'm sorry. I can't hear what you're saying. I'm sorry.
Oh man, I'm sorry. I was explaining to our listeners about the technical difficulties.
Oh, sorry.
You might have to cut some of the
what's and the huh's out.
That's all right. As I said before we started recording, I'm becoming much more confident in my editing abilities. I was just explaining and then inviting you to continue.
Well, I don't know. I don't really have a ton to say. You know, like I said, I do enjoy science fiction a lot. I'm certainly not, you know, somebody who can check off all the great works. Just hit and miss like anybody, I suppose. You know, I've read my share of, you know, Star Trek novelizations and other, you know, not exactly great. I suppose you just say a sort of a good, you know, cross the board sampling of science fiction would be you know, what I've been into.
Cool. I'm much the same way. I vastly tend toward the more soft end of the spectrum. I very much more enjoy the kind of the more sociological aspects of the genre. You know, like I want to, you know, I don't necessarily need to know all the physics that go behind like an amazing device. I want to know how it really screws up everyone's society. I think I'm coming at a similar way there. Similarly, it was my dad's paperbacks that got me into it all. He, as a lad in a small farming town in Illinois, snapped up every single paperback in the drugstore he could find that was about something far, far away and ultra. So he had this massive bookshelf of mid-century, like 60s and 70s science fiction paperbacks that I availed myself of. And probably much like with your Clive Cussler and Mike Crichton, like I probably ended up reading things that maybe I shouldn't have been reading when I was 10 or 11, but you know, I was sort of given free rein. And I fell away from I kind of fell and much like yourself, I really don't want to admit to how many 90s Star Wars novels I read. but I kind of fell away from the genre as I got into college. I allowed myself to think of it as somehow beneath me or that I needed to like spread my wings a little bit. And so I did. And I read a lot more other stuff. But I really came back to it in a big way. And I think with a better sort of critical eye for the genre itself and writing and whatnot. So it is now absolutely the kind of fiction that I read the most. But it's not quite with this. I don't have quite the same patience for, shall we say, the genre's pitfalls that I used to. So one thing that's going to be, I think, interesting for me on this project is sort of seeing how not only all the great in the genre developed, but also where the annoying bullshit sort of developed.
Yeah.
As for Jules Verne specifically, I had never read a Verne straight up. I only knew his work just through cultural osmosis and, you know, seeing – you know, watching Mysterious Island on TNT or something. Like I only knew it through interpretation. And part of that was because I went along with the fact that his reputation in the English speaking world is that he's like a kid's writer, or that he's somehow like a sort of not very literary or something. And I was interested to learn in doing research for the show that is largely the fault of all of his translators. When Verne was first writing in the 19th century, the English language translators, being derisive of French as a language and people, really didn't do it any justice. So the English language translations that came out were all abridged or dumbed down and poorly edited. And so that, you know, for most of the time, everyone in the English speaking world was like, oh yeah, he writes, you know, loopy adventure stories for babies. But I was surprised to learn that was not the case, that his reputation in France is much, much more sort of honored and literary. So we actually went out of our way. The book that we're reading today is From Earth to the Moon. And I selected that one simply because, for one, I had never seen any adaptation of it beyond that famous clip of that early silent movie, La Voyage dans la Lune, by Georges Méliès, where the moon gets hit with a big projectile and weeps.
That's a loose adaptation.
That's a very loose adaptation, I came to learn. But it was one that it's one that I could come in fresh on, basically. And it was Verne's first big hit, too. This was published in 1865, which is interesting for a number of reasons, because it's set in the United States and is directly tied to the end of the Civil War. So he was basically writing about the not too distant future when he wrote this one. But Verne himself was born in, just to give you just a little, you know, chicken scratch background, he was born in 1828 in the port city of Nantes in Brittany, sort of in the eastern part of France, in the mouth of the Loire River. And apparently his father was an interesting character. He was very kind of severe, very pious. So growing up in the Verne household, his father had a nautical telescope that he kept pointed at the mechanical clock tower of a nearby abbey, like a monastery. And I just had to think that is just, of course, Jules Verne grew up in a house which had a nautical telescope pointed at a mechanical clock in a religious house. But he ended up, he lived to a pretty good age. He lived to 77. He died in 1902. And I think it's interesting, and I think pertinent, that his life basically spanned this mushrooming of industrialization and rapid technological acceleration. He was kind of the generation that experienced that firsthand. So with all that in mind, unless you had something, anything more to add before we jump into what the heck happens in From Earth to the Moon?
No, that's fine. I as far as this book goes, I have read it before, but it was, you know, probably sixth grade, something like that. And so except for the fact that, you know, the basic. You know, sketch of the plot. I did not really remember it at all. So it was almost like reading it new. A few times it was like, oh, yeah, that's happened. That's right. But then there were also several times where in my mind I was remembering something else happening. So,
yeah.
But it was practically a first read. It had been so long.
Yeah. And I think also you would have been reading a new translation, because we went with a translation from the 1990s. Right. From a Verne scholar named Walter James Miller, who had a personal chip on his shoulder about how every single English language translation was terrible. So any of the Dover Thrift editions, or those the 50-cent ones with lurid covers that you'll find at Walmart, those are all garbage. Don't read them. Read Walter James Miller. He had this wonderful annotated edition that with these wonderful footnotes all through the text, which were really quite informative.
Yeah, it's a great book. Lots of good illustrations from the French copies, and yeah, just pretty much as much annotation as story almost.
Right, a lot more Freudian analysis than I expected.
Yeah,
but I guess we'll discover why maybe that was appropriate. So, From Earth to the Moon, published in 1865, opens up, describing the members of the Baltimore Gun Club. And this is just after the war. The Civil War has ended. And they're sitting around bemoaning the end of the war because they were all artillery engineers. That was the gun club, was a kind of society that they had developed during the war years to further the science of blasting human beings apart with horrible industrial efficiency, as was the game at the time. And this was kind of my first big surprise here. I really did not expect Verne to be such an arch and satirical writer. And right off the bat, he basically it will keep going in maybe a little more ambivalent, but like I was not expecting From Earth to the Moon to be a parody of American bellicosity, but it jumps right off with it.
Yeah, absolutely. The same thing really jumped out at me, that when I was a little kid reading it, I did not notice. And like you said, I was reading some terrible, yellowed old pulp right. version, but
yeah.
Yeah, it is very sarcastic and biting,
Yeah, and I'd love to read a passage just so y'all can get out there in Radio Land can get a flavor of this. So this is from the very first chapter of From Earth to the Moon. This is the gun club sitting around talking. "This is horrible," said Tom Hunter one evening while rapidly carbonizing his wooden legs in the fireplace of the smoking room. "Nothing to do, nothing to look forward to. What a loathsome existence. When again shall the guns arouse us in the morning with their delightful reports?" "Those days are gone by," said Jolly Bilsby, trying to extend his missing arms. "It was a delightful once upon a time. One invented a gun, and hardly was it cast than one hastened to try it in the face of the enemy. Then one returned to camp with a word of encouragement from Sherman or a friendly shake from the hand of McClellan. But now the generals are gone back to their counters, and in place of projectiles, they dispatch bales of cotton. By Jove, the future of gunnery in America is lost." "Aye, and no war in prospect," continued the famous James T. Maston, scratching with his steel hook his gutta percha cranium. "Not a cloud on the horizon, and that, too, at such a critical period in the progress of the science of artillery. Yes, gentlemen, I who address you have myself this very morning perfected a model of a mortar destined to change all the conditions of warfare." So, right as you can see there, as an aside, Verne is pointing out the parts of their bodies that have been blown off and mangled in their pursuits. As they whine about no longer being able to create implements of destruction.
And this version here that we had has a great illustration with it too.
That engraving is terrific. there are a number of really delightful illustrations that I would urge anybody, if you listen to this episode and you're intrigued, please seek out these the Williams translations that's annotated for Birds of the Moon. It's terrific. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Gigi.
I was just going to say, and every time they're mentioned, they always make a point, to mention, such and such, with his missing legs. He had two peg legs, and this guy has two hooks. And every single – they always make sure – he always makes sure to mention that.
Right. And so it's right off the bat, we're like, okay, like he's a playful writer. Which really sort of belies his reputation. So as the evening wears on, these members of the gun club, kind of the primary characters we'd be following from here are the President Impey Barbicane, J.T. Maston, a General Morgan, and a Major Elphiston, resolve among themselves that the solution to this malaise, the solution to this what are we to do to advance the science of artillery, they're going to shoot the moon. That's right, everybody. They commit themselves to the idea of firing a projectile to the moon using their science as artillerists. And following up on this, we get what may be the first of, this is one of those kind of annoying tropes you see crop up again and again in science fiction, the info dump. Because we have a chapter devoted to... They send a letter to the Cambridge Observatory. I guess this must be like associated with Yale University, I suppose. Harvard is at Cambridge. Excuse me. I mixed up my Ivies. Uh-oh. Oh, God. Oh, I know. They're really going to come for me now. But there's an entire chapter devoted to a letter sent to this observatory and its response, where stipulating all of the various, like, the like how, you know, where can we best place this cannon on the planet Earth? When would be the time to shoot? Like, what kind, you know, how far away is the moon? What kind of initial velocity would we need? And then so there's the letter back from the observatory answering all of this in detail, all calculated out for us, the listener, or the reader, rather, which I will not inflict on you.
There's a lot of math in this book. I don't know enough to check his formulas, but there's a lot of math in this.
There really is. Yeah. So the upshot is sort of capturing it all that these gentlemen in the gun club, who have already, with their announcement, captured the imagination of the country without even knowing how far away the moon is yet. But they get all they need to know. So first, the cannon ought to be planted in a country situated between 0 degrees and 28 degrees north or south of latitude. So you got to be close to the equator to get your best shot. It ought to be pointed directly at the zenith of the moon. The projectile ought to be propelled with an initial velocity of 12,000 yards per second. It ought to be discharged at 10 hours, 46 minutes, and 40 seconds on the 1st of December of the next year, because that's when the moon will be at its closest to the planet Earth. It will meet the moon 4 days after its discharge, precisely at midnight on the 4th of December, at the moment of its transit across the zenith. The members of the gun club ought, therefore, without delay, to commence the works necessary for such an experiment and to be prepared to set to at work at the moment determined upon. For if they should suffer this 4th of December to go by, they will not find the moon again under the same conditions of perigee and of zenith until 18 years and 11 days afterwards. So there we have, basically, that's the whole plot wrapped up there. We have the conditions that they will have to engineer for this projectile and the ticking time clock. That all has to be done, basically, within a year's time. After that, we get an entire chapter devoted to Gigi. Do you remember that movie, The Mole People?
The Mystery Science Theater one.
Yeah, yes. They did it on Mystery Science Theater, and how it opens up with that boring guy doddering on about various hollow Earth theories.
Yes,
and the questing mind of man. So Jules Verne was on that trip a century before that guy, because has a whole chapter called The Romance of the Moon devoted to the strange questing mind of man, imagining the moon and what its inhabitants are like and how we might get there. So pretty bold of Verne to have back-to-back just plotless chapters.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. It would be so hard to put yourself in the mind of a reader in the 1860s, you know, many of the things they're talking about the moon here, you know, some of it, you know, we know was totally off base, and then other stuff to us seems, you know, pretty much like, yeah, there's craters on the moon. Yeah. Yeah. Big whoop.
Right.
Everybody
right.
knows that. You wonder right. how much of this was, you know, new information to the people reading it and, you know, something that they, you know, that you wonder, you know, in 1865, somebody reading this chapter, if it was all very interesting to them, or if it felt like an right. info dump to them too, you know?
Right, right. The thing is, like, that is, I think, can be a virtue in science fiction. I'll tell you right now that I first learned about basically like general relativity, you know, like Einsteinian physics. Mm-hmm. I learned about from science fiction. From reading science fiction stories that used things like, you know, time dilation as a plot point.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that's, you know, that's something that's, I think, very valuable and not necessarily unique to science fiction. You know, a lot of like, you know, historical fiction, for instance, can be informative in that manner. But yeah, this was just so it's very clear that this was written before our conventions of what a novel is like.
Right.
Had really gelled, because it's just very stark. It's just very like, it's not even a character explaining this. It's just Verne saying, you know, here's some stuff people thought about the moon.
Right. And it's, I mean, I certainly haven't, you know, read a ton of 19th century stuff, but it seems yeah. like that was definitely more the way they did it back then. And I honestly can't remember. Was this serialized initially, or was it as one publication?
I believe it was as one publication, because Vern had gotten a contract with a publisher earlier that year to basically crank out 3 books a year.
Okay.
So he was working for a publisher. So it wasn't necessarily he was writing stories and selling them to magazines or anything. Right. I'm sure he probably had some output like that, but I think this would have just been like, you know, dropped as one thing, sure. Which does make its kind of disjointed nature a little more odd, because you're right. Like, it feels more like, you know, if each chapter was like an installment,
yeah,
week to week,
it, yeah, it, you know, if you had told me, yeah, this thing came out in, you know, a magazine, you know, one chapter per month, it would have felt, you know, like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
I mean, there's a little bit here too at the beginning where you could almost mix up chapters a bit and it, you know, it wouldn't matter that much.
Right. It really wouldn't. There was, and sort of following up on this chapter, this questing mind of man portion, is I guess kind of a nod to what you were thinking about, like how informed would a typical 19th century reader be on these topics, because there is a chapter devoted to every American getting swept up in moon fever and reading up on all this stuff like apogees and orbits and Keplerian orbital mechanics and whatnot to get learnt, which was kind of, you know, kind of interesting. And another, you know, another info dump.
Well, I can see, you know, to the extent that he makes it happen in the book, it seems a little, I don't know about that, but you do see it. I mean, you know, with the last eclipse, the number of people, you know, going crazy with the last eclipse about it. And of course the number of people like, you know, making tons of money off of that.
Right. So right. Exactly.
People can get swept up in things like that, but it does seem a little bit where he's all, you know, it was the only news in every newspaper in the land. And I believe he numbers how many newspapers it's in too.
He does.
He's Vern very into the exact details, which,
yes, he,
you know,
is.
It's his thing. It's definitely not the way somebody would do it today, but that's definitely his thing, to give you the exact details when you could have said it was in hundreds of newspapers. No, he's going to tell you exactly how many.
And their circulations.
Yes.
and you get the feeling that, you know, he's like kicking back, like, you know, or like maybe like the – I guess the feeling he's trying to invoke in the reader is one of like respect for like, ah, yes, this fellow knows what I'm all about. I'm a no-nonsense guy and I like to see these numbers. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get a lot more of that as it goes on, because the next chapter sort of picks the plot back up. And there is a committee formed in the gun club. Oh, I guess we should have mentioned one insane thing about the gun club is that their clubhouse is like a cathedral made out of guns. I forgot to mention that in that first chapter, but it's literally like has columns that are fused cannons and like decorative chandeliers made of rifles and stuff. It's really a trip to read the description. And again, it has to be part of the send up, basically.
Yeah, if you know, I have seen some kind of movie version of this, but they certainly didn't do any justice to that in it. That, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you really, I mean, you need like a Tim Burton in set dressing for that.
Absolutely. But again, the engraving that was included in this edition does a pretty good job. It does look completely insane. So there's a committee formed of the leading lights of the gun club, Barbicane, Elphiston, Morgan, and Maston. And there's a chapter devoted to them basically hammering out the dimensions of the projectile. They start with, you know, how are we going to, you know, what kind of projectile are we going to be shooting? And in an interesting bit of, I think another trait that science fiction, that I think is typical of science fiction and almost definitional of it, is that it includes a little bit of science beyond science. And this is a term that I picked up from the wonderful history of the genre by Alexei Panshin, called World Beyond the Hill. And he, in his own genre history and his own sort of critical appraisal, mentions this as kind of one of the hallmarks of the genre, in that you would have writing that includes scientific knowledge or achievements that are not yet current, but are closely extrapolatable from current developments. And where Verne works this into this chapter is that his characters determined that the projectile will need to be made of aluminum. Now, this is a bit of science beyond science, because at the time Verne was writing, it would have been vastly prohibitively expensive to extract that much aluminum from aluminum ores. Scientists knew that aluminum was one of the most common elements on the surface of the Earth, but they had not developed a way to feasibly extract it from the ores that it was contained in, except by means of great expense. But the characters in talking about it mentioned that, like, oh yes, thanks to so-and-so's new process, aluminum should be such and such, you know, amount of money per pound by the time that we are purchasing it or whatever. And indeed, in a few years after the publication of this novel, I think maybe even like within like two or three, you had economically viable mass produced aluminum, which is, you know, pretty, you know what, Verne? Cool trick. You know, I got to hand it to you.
It was very interesting. I've seen, you know, in museums, they have like royal jewelry from the 1700s made of aluminum because it was, you know, like right up there with platinum at the time.
Right, right.
And when they capped the Washington Monument, they used an aluminum pyramid because it was, you know, the most expensive thing they could think of.
Because that was the most, right, that was the most, like, extravagant thing. And now, if you're pig-headed and don't, you know, and aren't a good recycler, you just throw that stuff out.
Right.
Yeah, it's like throwing away your gold can. I don't know. So following up on this, they determined that it needs to be 9 feet in diameter and 20,000 pounds. And they just decide, like, we'll just make it a sphere because we're just lobbing a thing. You know, at this point, they're basically just – they literally – all they want to do is shoot the moon. So it's just going to be like just a big cannonball. Excuse me. Made of aluminum. Then they go on to hammer out the dimensions of the cannon, eventually – arriving that it's going to be cast iron instead of bronze. It's going to be 900 feet long with a 9-foot bore. That's the empty part in the middle, and walls 6 feet thick. Then after that, they determine how the propellant will be all brought together for all this. And this is a little more of the science beyond science, because they determine that they're going to use gun cotton rather than gunpowder. And I'd heard the term gun cotton before, but had no idea what that actually was. I just assumed it was some kind of, like, I don't know, extra padding for a muzzle-loading musket or something. But apparently what it is you can take cotton just, like, in your clothes, cotton, and treat it with nitric acid, and it becomes an explosive. So much, much lighter weight than gunpowder. So that the idea here, and of course, at the time, this was similar to aluminum. No one had really been able to make it stable. Like, scientists knew that you could treat cotton with nitric acid and it would make this explosive, these explosive fibers. But it was very unstable and could, like, blow up out of nowhere. You know, like nitroglycerin in a Looney Tunes cartoon. But again, a couple of years after the publication of this novel, some enterprising fellow managed to make it stable. So it was like, again, points for Verne. There we go. A little bit later, there's kind of the next plot point. I will say that plot is – I don't even like to use the word plot for because really it's just kind of a bunch of stuff that happens. It's kind of hard to draw like a through line exactly. But there are things that crop up that then are addressed again later. And this is one of those. In a chapter called something like The One Dissenter Out of 25 Million. And again, this kind of hyperbole of like everyone has moon fever, but there's one guy. There's one guy who isn't going to fall for that.
Yes, the whole his one enemy scene, it's a pretty wild idea.
it's of all it is probably the least likely element in this book about a 900-foot moon cannon. But the man in question is a naval armor developer named Captain Nickel, and he is Barbicane's nemesis, the president of the gun club. And he is Barbicane's nemesis because, of course, he was in the business of creating impenetrable armor, whilst Barbicane was in the business of creating irresistible artillery. So they had a personal rivalry throughout the war, even though they were both on the Union side. But you know, Captain Nickel, I guess just for the sake of the honor of armor, was very upset that Barbicane kept, and of course, his professional pride that Barbicane kept developing artillery that could pierce his armor for the ironclad warships. So Captain Nickel, in his feverish hatred of Barbicane, his fixated fury, and this is where the annotations got a little Freudian on us, not without cause, it makes the point that there's a kind of erotic element to all this, with all the talk of penetration versus fear of penetration. Captain Nickel makes a wager against every stage of the project. So, like, you know, I bet you $2,000 that you can't dig the shaft to cast the cannon, and I bet you $3,000 that you can't, you know, melt the iron to cast the whatever. So he basically, it all adds up to 15,000 buckaroonies in $1865, which, adjusting for inflation is a whole buttload of money. But Barbicane accepts. He accepts this wager. So there's a little interpersonal conflict frisson there, which will not be addressed again for a number of chapters.
Which he puts the razzle dazzle on it a little bit, but all of his points are very sound on why these things would not work. And I guess that's Verne's way of getting through it, you know, putting the objections that he obviously knew about into the voice of the bad character so he could dismiss them.
Right, exactly. Like, oh, yeah, you might think this is too outlandish, but that just makes you a bitter old, you know, naval armor expert. So in one of the more, I guess, you know, the stranger chapters, there's predicting, you know, accurately how spaceflight on the North American continent was going to work. Verne, of course, determined that, for the gun club, they have to put their cannon somewhere below the 28th parallel. So, you know, closer to onto the equator. And there are only two states in the entire Union. Well, they're recently, you know, the recently subjugated Confederacy, you might say.
Yeah, you might not want to say. Watch your phrasing in 1865. Right,
this is 1865. That is still militarily occupied territory, which, again, is very strange. Like, Verne clearly did not have a very good grasp on just how raw this all was in 1865. Because the way he writes, it's just like, okay, well, the war's over. You know, everyone's fine now. You know, the war is over and it's all decided. We're all one Union again.
That may be the biggest fiction in the book.
Exactly.
Most outlandish ideas.
Jules Verne, read Reconstruction by Eric Foner. Do better. The only territory in the United States that fits these parameters is going to be either in Florida or Texas, the southernmost states in the Union. And so there is a massive uproar of the partisans of Texas and Florida who travel to Baltimore to harangue the gun club about which state shall have the honor of hosting the moon gun. And the gun club eventually goes with Florida. They go with Tampa, which I can't tell you why I thought that was so funny. It's just something, I don't know, something about Tampa. But they go with a site that's sort of in the heights above Tampa. And part of their reasoning is because, well, that's the only site in Florida that it would be suitable to us. So we can go ahead and we give it to Florida. We know we're going to have it right there. If they went with Texas, then there were like 10 sites that would then keep fighting with each other about where to place it. And we don't have time for that.
He does have to do a little bit of hand waving on elevations in Florida.
I noticed that in that the site that's picked, it's within a day's travel of Tampa, but it's also 1,800 feet above sea level. And I don't think that's right.
I mean, I'm 1,800 feet above sea level here, and we're definitely higher than Florida. I think Florida, it's more like 18 feet.
Yeah, yeah, that was a bit odd, but we'll allow him these flights of fancy. It was pretty amusing.
I think he got into it a little bit and then realized that his gun would be 3/4 full of water and he didn't have anything right around that without. Oh yeah. Oh wait. Oh, there was a hill. Yeah, there was a hill.
There was a big old hill. It was very dry. We loved it. but in a kind of parody of American bellicosity, which runs through this whole novel. The Texas delegation, the partisans of Texas, are so outraged that they're basically rioting in the streets, and the Baltimore police has to round them up and just herd them into cattle cars on a train and just like slap the train's ass and get it to just haul 30 miles per hour out of town just to get them out of Baltimore, which was a pretty amusing element.
I did like that. That 30 miles an hour was like really getting them out of their fast.
That is hauling ass to go 30 miles an hour. So following up on that, we have another, Gigi, I know that you love numbers. I know that you love lists of numbers. How would you like a list of all of the states of Europe and the amounts that they contributed to the gun club for the completion of this moon gun project? Would you like to read an entire chapter of that? Because I certainly would. And thankfully, Jules Verne has provided it.
Yeah, it's quite a you talk about, his lists of things, and the lists of every country contributed exactly this many dollars. And, he obviously was grinding a few axes in places there on these countries that, Oh, but these, I believe, wasn't it England didn't even give one single
England,
dollar at all, right. Or one single pound because of their stupid English.
I believe there was a passage in that said, as the English share one soul among their 20 millions, they did not contribute a single penny. Yeah, the English don't chip in at all. He also got in a dig. I thought this was interesting. He got in a dig at, so kind of Verne's personal politics were very staunchly little R Republican. He was a great admirer of the United States and the Union side in the Civil War specifically, partly because he at the time was living under the Second French Empire under Napoleon III, which he really loathed. He really despised it. He felt it was a real betrayal of the entire spirit of the French Revolution and this kind of little R Republicanism that he believed in. So he mentions that Mexico put forth a paltry $300. And this was in part a dig at Napoleon III, because I believe at the time of this writing, it was Napoleon III's invasion of Mexico had kind of like taken it over in order to create an allied empire of Mexico that would be allied to the Bonaparte house. So that was his little dig at Napoleon III. So there's a couple of interesting things in this chapter, but mostly it is like, and Denmark, little Denmark provided $9,000, and it's just on and on and on. But we finally get to the project of actually digging the 900-foot shaft into that great rocky outcropping outside of Tampa that we all know and love. And of course, there's a great deal of triumphalist engineering talk going on with that. And they begin it, though. He talks about shipping in 1,500 laborers from New Orleans, having been recruited, there in the port of New Orleans. And there's a little passage I thought was very interesting. Let's see.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here we go, yeah. Attracted by the high pay and considerable bounties offered by the gun club, he had enlisted a choice legion of stokers, iron founders, lime burners, miners, brick makers, and artisans of every trade, without distinction of color, black and white. As many of these people brought their families with them, their departure resembled a perfect emigration. This is 1865, and Vern is proposing that there is colorblind hiring in New Orleans. And it's just... It's just like I do appreciate that Vern truly admired the Union cause and this and the anti-racism which it came to represent. Of course, that's its whole other story of how the Union cause came to be anti-slavery and anti-racist. But it is this kind of Pollyanna-ish vision there. I thought was pretty interesting.
But then he pairs it right up with your most stereotypical possible Native Americans. So
yeah.
I had totally forgotten that part of it. It's like, woo, that's a little.
So he mentions the Seminole people as being like, they're there and they kind of vaguely menace the great intrepid engineers and their laborers and whatnot. And there's a kind of like, I don't know. There's a certain ambivalence through all this toward, like, even as Vern is clearly enamored of the great power sort of latent and being expressed in industrialism and industrialization, he still allows for there to be actors in these novels that are suspicious of it. And I guess it's not that great that they have to be like very stereotypical Indian people, but at least they're there and they're sort of hanging away from it because they don't really, they don't like what's going on with it. And there was another moment in this particular chapter, sort of struck me as being pretty, again, as Vern being aware of the built-in inhumanities of industrialization and these kind of pharaonic projects, and yet making excuses for his characters. And it says here, many workmen, it is true, paid with their lives for the rashness inherent in these dangerous labors. But these mishaps are impossible to be avoided, and they are classed among the details with which the Americans trouble themselves but little. Well, that part's true. They have, in fact, more regard for human nature in general than for the individual in particular. Nevertheless, Barbicane professed opposite principles to these and put them in force at every opportunity. So thanks to his care, his intelligence, his useful intervention in all difficulties, his prodigious and humane sagacity, the average of accidents did not exceed that of transatlantic countries, noted for their excessive precautions. France, for instance, among others, where they reckon about one accident for every 200,000 francs of work. So it's really like, some people died, but not as many as could have died if my guy wasn't so good and strong and my friend.
I mean, his character, his hero characters do tend to be, very perfect. So I guess, I guess you can at least say it wasn't like, nobody was even hurt at all or, something, like that, which would have been pretty unbelievable. But still, this is the number of, this country contributed this many dollars, and yeah, this is how many people died doing this part of it, and this is how many people died doing that part of it. You know, we got to keep the numbers straight.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was very interesting. It's kind of a, like, he has invented for himself a kind of idealized industrial owner. Like, he's invented for himself basically a kind of idealized industrial capitalist, in that he, you know, is he's the man with all the expertise. He's the owner and the director, but he's also the man with all the expertise. He intervenes at all points to correct his workers and for their own safety, because he has their best interest at heart. You know, all this kind of stuff is basically like setting up like the, and, you know, as we know from history, not at all how mass industrialization worked, but it's almost as though like a kind of like, he's writing a hagiography for what, you know,
but I'm sure
this is how it could have been.
But I'm sure Thomas Edison read that and they're like, yeah, that I am a pretty good guy.
Exactly. That's exactly it. It's like this, it's this apologia for the tyrannical power that industrial capitalists held over their workforces. You know, mm-hmm. It's just, it was very interesting for me to note. But with all that work done, we finally have the casting of the Great Cannon. So picture for yourself, there's a 900 foot shaft in the earth of the tallest mountain in Florida. and into that is built in the middle a tower of packed clay, which is going to, you know, when they pour the mold in, that will be the bore hole that the projectile will shoot through. And so they have it all. They have 1,200 furnaces arranged around the Great Pit. And this, I think, was the passage that's the most, I don't know, lyrical and just the most emotional in the entire novel, was his description of when the moment to cast the Great Cannon came. And so I marked it here, and if you'll permit me, Gigi, I want to read it for our listeners here. Mm-hmm. The casting was set for noon. The day before, each furnace had been charged with 114,000 pounds of iron bars stacked crosswise to each other so that the hot air could circulate freely among them. Since morning, 1,200 chimneys had been belching torrents of flame into the air, and the ground was shaking with dull tremors. For every pound of metal to be cast, a pound of coal had to be burned. Thus, there were 68,000 tons of coal, sending a thick curtain of smoke across the face of the sun. This is all written in such triumphalist language. It was just this ecological holocaust being perpetrated. Inside the circle of furnaces, the heat soon became unbearable. Their roar resembled the rumble of thunder. Powerful fans added to the noise of the continuous blasts as they fed fresh oxygen to the glowing hearths. To guarantee success, the operation had to be carried out very swiftly. The firing of a cannon would be the signal for releasing the liquid metal, for emptying every furnace. When the preliminaries were completed, the foreman and all hands waited for the signal with impatience and mounting excitement. There was no one inside the circle now. Each foundry master stood at his post, ready to open the tap holes. Barbicane and his colleagues, stationed on a nearby rise of land, supervised the operation. They were ready to fire a cannon as soon as the engineer gave his signal. Shortly before noon, the first drops of metal began to flow. The basins filled up gradually. When the iron was entirely molten, it was allowed to stand for a few moments to facilitate the separation of impurities. At noon, the cannon abruptly fired, sending a tawny flash into the air. 1,200 tap holes were opened simultaneously. 1,200 fiery serpents unfolded their incandescent coils and crept toward the central pit. There was a terrific noise as they dropped 900 feet. It was a moving, magnificent spectacle. The ground trembled as these cascades of molten metal, sending whirls of smoke toward the sky, volatilized the moisture in the core mold and sent it through the vent holes in the stone revetment in the form of dense vapors. Artificial clouds spiraled toward the zenith, reaching a height of 3,000 feet. A savage, wandering on the other side of the horizon, would have thought some new crater was being formed in the heart of Florida, but there was neither eruption nor tornado nor tempest nor clash of the elements. None of those terrible catastrophes nature is capable of producing. No, it was man alone who had created these reddish vapors, these gigantic flames worthy of a volcano, these loud tremors like a shock of an earthquake, these reverberations rivaling the sound of hurricanes. It was his hand that had flung into an abyss he had created, a whole Niagara of molten metal. Folks, now there's some industrial triumphalism.
And his description here of his chapter about casting the cannon, he gets into that way more than actually firing it off. It, you know,
yeah, yeah.
That's definitely I mean, to me anyway, that seems like that was his favorite part. You really see him getting into it.
I could almost feel him like scratching like madly on this paper, like his notebook, like yes, yes, yes. And then the molten torrents, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, that was easily the emotional high point of the novel, I would say, was casting the cannon. Mm-hmm. We do have a little bit of human drama being injected, though, soon after, because a telegram arrives from a French adventurer named Michel Ardan, who requests that the sphere projectile be changed to a bullet-shaped one with provisions for him to be inside it. So this Michel Ardan is a pretty interesting character. It's a composite of people that Verne knew. It's mostly based on Verne's close friend, Felix Tournachon, who went by the pseudonym Nadar. I don't know how he would pronounce it. And he was best known in France for being the inventor of aerial photography. He was the first guy to take a daguerreotype camera up in a hot air balloon and take some pictures. And he was also, interestingly, he was also the guy who first was kind of the go-between to get Verne a contract with those publishers for these technological wonder stories he was going to be writing. So as a kind of as a kind of nod to this friend who really got this ball rolling, the easily the most heroic character of the novel is named after an anagram of his pseudonym. So Ardan, on his arrival, holds a mass meeting because of course by now, I guess we haven't mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people are always milling around watching the great task being done. This is apparently like the population of Tampa has now exploded and has over 100,000 people living there just on the curiosity of the great moon gun. So Ardan holds this massive meeting to explain himself and his ideas to this massive crowd. He spins this kind of a strange vision of like mass passenger service trains of projectiles shot from moon cannons. Like you would have like a literal train of a bunch of projectiles like holding like, you know, like a, well, like train passengers, and they'd be fired out of a moon cannon to go on a pleasure cruise around the moon. But Ardan and Barbican agree, you know, people are raising all kinds of objections. They all agree that the moon itself is totally uninhabitable. It would not have any air, you know, and you know, Verne gets that right. Of course, he actually has a pretty good grip on what the moon is like. But he also would think that every human would want to do a flyby by being shot out of a gigantic cannon. And so Ardan has this vision of a cannonball train. It's just very strange, but it has a lovely, just a very charming engraving with it. I'm hoping to post after this episode goes up. I want to post that on the show social media feeds, because it's my absolute favorite thing. It's like a locomotive projectile and a train and a caboose, and it has a little smokestack.
Yes,
it's really adorable.
It's very interesting. For me, his character is just a little bit too much. You know, he's the kindest, bravest, most wonderful man anyone has ever met. You know,
he's famous.
He's so
everyone knows him.
You know, he's beautiful. You know, he's a genius. He's so brave. He's so generous. You know, his only fault is that, you know, he's too brave. If Verne had an editor, they might have told him something like, you know, hey, dial it back a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah, because it is very much like a kind of like, I mean, clearly Verne thought very highly of his friend.
Yes.
So he was just like, and my bestie is the coolest, and he's so handsome. He looks like a lion. He is so good. So in any case, Barbican agrees to let him. They're going to change what the projectile is to allow a human being to be inside it, to go on this trip. And, you know, I mentioned how, like, there's not so much plot as things are broached and then are brought back again later. Well, Captain Nickel is back. The enemy of Barbican, who had made that massive wager, He had now, of course, I think at this point in the project, he was down like $10,000 because he had lost a bunch of the bets. So Captain Nickel challenges Barbicane to a duel. And the way that Vern has it, this is apparently a specific type of American duel called a Kentucky duel. And I really – I thought this was fantastic. So it says here, he writes, "Nothing is more dreadful than private duels in America. The two adversaries attack each other like wild beasts. Then it is that they might well covet those wonderful properties of the Indians of the prairies, their quick intelligence, their ingenious cunning, their scent of the enemy. A single mistake, a moment's hesitation, a single false step may cause death. On these occasions, Yankees are often accompanied by their dogs and keep up the struggle for hours." So apparently there was this type of duel that instead of, like, you know, shooting at 10 paces, it was basically like, you know, all right, we're going to be in these woods at the same time, and you better brought your best bloodhounds and your finest rifle because we're hunting each other like the most dangerous game, which,
yes, is, you know, that was something I'd never heard of that before.
Never heard of it. I never heard of it.
You know, you wonder, I don't know. You know, like you said, it seems to be a thing that sort of existed, but you wonder if he didn't, you know, he read some newspaper article back in France and you're like, oh yeah, right, that's what everybody always does in America.
Exactly.
Because that is certainly not, you know, what comes to mind, my mind, if you say you're going to have a duel.
Right. Yeah. And even then, like, I mean, what's the most famous duel in American history? Hamilton versus Spur. Right. And that was absolutely like a 10 paces and shoot deal, you know. Yeah. So now that's not to say that things weren't rough, you know, out Kentucky way, you know, sort of in the sort of expansion of white settlers days. There was a form of personal combat called eye gouging, which was the martial art of the kind of Kentucky and Northwestern Territories frontier, which literally was you would just get your thumbs in the other guy's eyes until he gave up or you popped those eyeballs. And that's real. And so, you know, I'm willing to say probably the Kentucky duel happened at some point. But I think you're right, Gigi, that like this the way it's written, Vern seems to think, or like wants the audience to think like, oh, yeah, this is how Americans are all the time.
Yeah, this is every week that, you know, every town in America, people are going out and most dangerous at gaming themselves.
Right, right. Which is, again, this he has this notion of Americans as this just implacably hostile, bellicose people.
Which is not exactly.
Again, I can't fault him too much on that. But on getting news of this, that Barbicane and Nickel were doing this Kentucky duel out in the woods outside of Tampa and in the lofty mountains outside of Tampa, Ardan and JT Maston of the Gun Club race into the woods to try to find them. And I want to get your read on this, Gigi, because I thought this was pretty interesting. They first happen upon Nickel, who has set his rifle down, leaving himself just a sitting duck. He set his rifle down and is rescuing a bird that's been trapped in a massive spider web. And so they walk up to him in this moment of mercy that he's, you know, performing, and explain that they're like, look, we don't want you guys to kill each other. Let's all go together and find Barbicane. And then they find Barbicane, again, you know, not paying attention to his surroundings like you might if you were being hunted in the most dangerous game. And they find him sketching sort of doing rough calculations, resolving the G-force problem for how Ardan was going to survive being shot out of a cannon. He comes up with apparently he arrives at some kind of like segmented layered water cushion kind of thing. In any case, so they all walk up together and peace is made between Barbicane and Nickel when Ardan suggests that, why don't you guys both come with me in the projectile? And they're all for it and no hard feelings.
It felt very weird to me. The whole, you know, they're both, you know, they're both men of science. They're both, you know, really not that violent, you know, they're saved the animal, you know,
or not that personally violent,
but it's, I guess, so yeah. Completely, you know, like 3 pages before, you know, this, he's having like a fit and challenging him to a duel. It seems like,
right,
there's something missing in there to make that even seem, it just does not you know, A doesn't follow B. It's a very weird transition they do there.
Yeah, yeah. And it is kind of – it resolves the conflict between Nickel and Barbicane. And I think the annotations made note of this that, like, apparently Nickel was just upset because he wasn't included. And so all of this was just – he was so upset about not being included on the grandest scientific project of the age that he was ready to shoot one of the head guys of it.
Which, you know, that's not bad, but it seems like that should have been on the page more. That's a perfectly good character development in there, but it was handled very weirdly to me.
Right, it's nowhere. It's nowhere to be found. Like earlier in the text, it's really entirely by inference that you even get any of it. And for a guy who spends an entire chapter laying out how much money friggin' Portugal gave to the gun club, you'd think he could spare a moment or two to sort of give a little more detail on the motivations of these characters.
Yes. Honestly, none of the characters are characters. You know,
they're not.
You can barely even call them archetypes. They're cardboard cutouts. You know, this is the good scientist, and this is the jealous scientist. You know, right. And this is the perfect explorer. That to me, that's even more than the lists of of who donated how many dollars. The one dimensional character sort of thing,
right?
That which is hardly unique to him as far as science fiction goes.
Exactly. Yeah. What I thought is kind of, I guess we can talk more about it when we kind of wrap up the plot synopsis here. But like, there's a lot in science fiction that is present right at the beginning in this novel. So with all that resolved there, the interpersonal conflict resolved, there's a little bit about more explaining about how they're going to chemically create breathable air to have with them for a couple of months worth. There's discussion about the massive telescope, which will be constructed in the Rocky Mountains to observe it all, which is, again, prescient of Mr. Verne, because that is scientists would soon conclude that what you want to do to get good readings through a telescope is to get it as high up as possible, so you have as little atmospheric disturbance of light particles as possible. So we finally get to the gun being fired, with the projectile is loaded up in there. Ardan, Barbicane, and Nickel are all in there. The gun is fired, deafening all the onlookers. And in something I thought was pretty hilarious, the ever avid Maston apparently was standing too close when the thing went off, and it says he was blown 100 feet back. Yes. Which I think if you're already a man with like two hooks for hands and a skull that's half made out of like ebony, and you get blown 100 feet and you're already like 50, like, come on, man, you're dead. But apparently not. He's an American, so he's made of tough stuff. I thought an interesting touch was that Verne mentions that this boom was, of course, heard all across the continent and even across the ocean in Africa. The last faint reverberations of that vibration were heard as a kind of low rumble by the inhabitants of Guinea. And then in a marvelously anticlimactic turn, cloudy weather all across the United States. So no one can actually check in their telescopes to see if it's going anywhere or if they all just like blew up or if it's crashed back. No one can see anything for like 4 days. And then the clouds finally clear. There's a big storm. The clouds finally clear. The observatory on top of the Rocky Mountains is able to conclude that they have seen the projectile. And by their calculations, it has entered orbit around the moon, either to eventually crash into it or to just orbit forever, as our three intrepid astronauts die of suffocation. And that's the end.
I had totally forgotten it ends on a cliffhanger like this.
It ends on a cheap cliffhanger.
I apparently had read, the sequel, And I had totally it might have even been, you know, an edition that combined the two together.
I was going to say, I think typically they're published together. Yeah.
So I totally I got to the end. I'm like, wait, what? We're not even getting to the good stuff here. It's like,
right.
It's like a book about building a giant cannon.
It's a book about raise fundraising to build a giant cannon. Yes. Yeah, I was really taken aback by that. I was like, I was getting close to the end, like, okay, well, you know, are they gonna, you know, they're gonna wrap this up? Like, what are they doing here? And like, nope, just no. And I have to think part of that is like, you know, Vern was under contract to deliver 3 books a year. Mm-hmm. What better way to do that than to just, yeah, I'll break up one idea into 2 books.
Yes, yes.
Because, I think we might be seeing some savvy.
Because this is absolutely not, you know, if this is absolutely, you know, half of the story. That It's not that satisfying to end where he ends it.
And I think, I guess, you know, spoiler alert for everybody, in the sequel, which I have not read, I read the little synopsis at the end of this book here. It turns out that actually they just whipped around the moon and then flew back to Earth and crashed into the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they don't actually land on the moon.
They don't land on the moon. Well, you know, of course they did, because they can't get off again because it was a friggin' gun that shot them there.
Yeah,
I have to wonder, like, what did any of them expect to happen? It's very odd. And also, but I mean to say, like, that resolution of this cliffhanger is itself anticlimactic, because like it turns out, like, oh yeah, actually we weren't trapped. It was fine. You know, here we just got a little wet, and I guess they probably relate their story of, you know, what happened and what they saw. But
which is another thing that ties into like what I was saying, how it really feels serialized. How they promise things they do not deliver.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I'm having to look up right now to see if it was in fact initially published in a serialized format, because it just makes much more sense. If that's the way, because there's a lot of later science fiction would do that. Like, I remember reading Foundation. I know you said you hadn't read much Asimov, and I haven't really either, but I read Foundation. And I remember thinking when I first read it that it seemed kind of episodic and disjointed. And there's a good reason for that, and that's because it's what's called a fix-up. Mm-hmm. It was originally independently published short stories set in the same conceptual universe, but they were published as just their own separate short stories. And only later, like in some cases, like 10 years after the publication of the first story, was it compiled into a novel. And that's what's called a fix-up. And that was very, very common in mid-century science fiction. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. I'm looking this up here. First part. Got plots. Okay, location date. Yeah, so it looks like it was printed. Yeah, it was printed as a hardback book in 1865. That was there. It was,
but yeah,
which is odd.
Yeah, if you're gonna write a book from the Earth to the Moon, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, I guess it delivers, but not really. You know, when you see that title, you expect that you're going to be getting a lot of, you know, going to
a lot of moon. A lot of moon content, right?
It's more like the preparation for it.
Right, right. It would be like, you know, we write a book called Apollo 11. And the entire book is about the engineering and construction of the Saturn V.
Yeah, and then the last pages, and they shot the rocket off.
Yeah, I mean, it really was something. But the thing is, like, I will say, like, you know, we've had a lot of fun here today, nitpicking, making fun. I really enjoyed this much more than I expected to. Because the reputation Vern has is, and I realize now there's of course a reason for it, is like. Well, we were talking earlier about how both of us sort of tend toward the soft end of the spectrum and like the hard science fiction versus more sort of, you know, less hard, we might say. Yeah. I believe there's a page on TV Tropes, which don't ever go to that website, but calls it the Mohs scale of science fiction hardness. And it's a little geology joke there about mineral hardness. But But Verne has the reputation as being the hard science fiction guy. And he's often contrasted with H.G. Wells in this respect. But I think it's interesting to reflect on the fact that H.G. Wells wasn't born until 2 years after this book was published. Like, Wells and Verne were contemporaries, sort of. But Verne was a generation ahead of Wells. I think part of why he has this reputation for being the hard science fiction guy comes in part because he's establishing a lot of points in the genre. He's not really the beginning point of the genre. And I guess we didn't really I might do, another sort of a bonus extra episode to sort of talk about the various scholarship on where science fiction begins. Mm-hmm. But typically most everyone accepts Frankenstein as being the first science fiction novel. And that, of course, was, 20 years before Jules Verne was born. But I think part of his reputation for being the hard science fiction guy is because he really was, and I think in a way that likely wasn't common at the time, he was working science concepts into this fiction in a concrete way. He was really, he did the back of the envelope calculations for his characters to be able to say, we're going to need X amount of iron. We're going to need to fire this projectile at such and such velocity. And that's something that can be done in a ham-handed way, that can be done in a more elegant way. It can be done. I don't necessarily go for science fiction where that's the point. A lot of people in the fandom will, the literary fandom, where they'll get upset at a book because its science is bad, and that's to me just completely missing the point of what a science fiction novel is trying to do. But I'm being very rambly right now, and I just want to say that I actually really did enjoy the experience of reading this, because Verne is much funnier than I would have thought. He's very arch. He's very sarcastic. He's very ironic in a way that makes all of his – it makes it so much more confusing as to why these characters are such cardboard cutouts. If he has enough sort of sense to be this arch in his writing, then he has – a notion of human emotion. He's smart. He knows. I don't know. It was a very strange contrast.
Some of his descriptions of the gun club could be something Twain could have done, but nothing that like that.
Right. Twain could have that very, of course, has that wry sensibility, but it also shows in the way that characters are written. And in Verne, his narrator voice is very wry. Mm-hmm. But his actual dialogue, no one says anything that comes close to a joke, really, in universe. It's a joke.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Verne will put a joke in their mouths, but none of the people in their speaking are trying to make a joke.
I wonder how much of that comes from, even with the better translation, how much of that comes from translation, because humor is such a hard thing to translate,
and
from
it is
one language
so dependent.
To another. If you were sitting in France in 1865, if something in the dialogue would have made you laugh, it doesn't feel like it.
And I guess maybe part of that is because he's writing in part that this is a kind of satire of American militarism.
Right.
That perhaps it's necessary that these people be totally humorless. It has to be deadpan. Right. And I would be curious. I haven't read any, I have not read any other Verne. And I've seen 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I've seen Mysterious Island. I would wonder if maybe the sort of interior life of, say, Captain Nemo has more texture and depth to it than these guys. I guess this is me saying, everyone, I'm willing to read more Jules Verne.
Yeah. And it has its flaws, but it's a quick move. It moves quickly. You get it. Even when you get a totally off tangent digression, it's like a 2-page chapter. So it's refreshing compared to a Stephen King doorstopper.
Right.
And all of Verne's stuff is, compared to the way most of your science fiction today is written, by the pound, it's always, he does do short stories, which I think plays to his strengths.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the way it's written would not be as enjoyable in a 1,000-page book. You know, in,
exactly.
in a 50-page book, it's, you know, it just moves right along.
Right, right. I think you're exactly right. And I think the – and I think maybe even sort of writing so episodically, Vern is playing to his strengths. Right. In that, you know, you can – even if you're in the middle of the you know, man's searching quest for knowledge of the moon chapter, you know it's not going to go on that long. And there's also interesting right. tidbits in there. Like, it is interesting to read about, like, what this or that classical author conjectured about the moon. Like, then, you know, that's – all right. But yeah, you know that it's not going to go on that long and we're going to move on to something else, you know, pretty soon. But, yeah, I guess any, I don't know, any concluding thoughts on, From Earth to the Moon? I thought this was a very valuable reading experience.
Yeah, it's, and you know, it does not feel like something written in 1865. It, you know, you were, I don't know if, you know, I don't know if I could say exactly when it feels like, but if you'd told me it was written in, you know, 1910, it's very, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It,
yeah.
It, you know, it's all, you know, trains and guns, and but it feels more modern than a lot of your 19th century writing, even yeah. with the, you know, characteristics that, you know, market as being older, the, you know, the one-dimensional characters.
Right.
But, yeah, I enjoyed it. I, like I said, I've read several of his books a long time ago, and I don't really remember a lot about everything. I mean, I know I read this. I read the continuation on to, you know, where they go all the way, you know, they go around the moon. I've read
it's called Onward to the Moon or something like that. Like,
yes.
Oh yeah, we'll actually get to the moon this time.
Right.
it's honestly, this book should have called From Earth at the Moon.
Yeah.
And I think I would have been a little less upset.
Right.
Yeah. But all right, man. Well, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Jules Verne and From Earth to the Moon. And I'm looking forward to continuing our exploration of the science fictional genre universe. We have a few more. I've teed up a few more selections from the 19th century for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not out of those. We're not out of those Victorian woods yet. But it's all very interesting stuff. Some of it new to me. Some of it not. I'm sure it'll be likewise for you, Gigi. But I hope everyone listening at home had a good time. And yeah, I hope you're ready to continue on and join us as we explore the genre history of science fiction through the works themselves. And yeah, thank you so much, Gigi. Yeah. And we'll see everybody next time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.